The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
My co-host is in the building, Andisa West. And guess what? She was early.
I feel as though being early is the norm and being late is the exception. Once or twice. That's not...
I can't ever remember you being early. I'm just thinking, I try and remember when last you was early. The last time you was here, you was late, right? Yeah. I remember.
And the time before that?
Late.
The time before that, I was early.
I can't remember that. I had to talk to security downstairs. But my co-host on a Friday, she's not a guest. She's my co-host. And this segment is known as Justice. This is where we talk law. And I want to remind persons that most of the questions that you may have, that you may ask us, is all generic, the advice. Remember, they have to know your case, know your story, in order to give you comprehensive advice on your matter. But in the interim, generic advice can be given. You can learn something as to how to mitigate and navigate through legal things in your life, even if it's a land dispute. Well, you know what's going on with the agency now when you're dead. You find big money to transfer. So good morning, ladies. How are you? Thank you very much, Miss Roberto, is it?
Good morning, Davey. How are you? Good morning.
Fix that mic. Turn it a little bit. Right.
Good morning, everyone.
Yeah. You good?
I'm good. And
you ain't sounding good. You sound like you had a cold. Yeah.
I feel like I'm getting it.
Stay right there, please. All right, stay downwind, stay on that side.
Smashing up everybody, to be honest.
Well, I know you had it and you couldn't even make it to work. That's
no, honestly.
She couldn't.
Honestly, that was the worst. I actually have a little cousin and she was in the hospital because of it. It was terrible. It was she's a baby.
Oh, well.
Which is why, yeah.
Well, okay. Well, everybody's okay, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. So, ladies, we're talking sufficiency hearing. What is a sufficiency hearing? But before you get to that part, I have a question. What is a prima facie case? What is that?
Well,
a prima facie here. What is that?
So a prima facie case is the aspect of, well, in simple terms, the court has to be satisfied that there's evidence, some evidence to substantiate the charge that has been laid against you. The threshold for someone to be found guilty for a criminal offense is beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the burden on the state. The state must prove every charge, every offense that accused person is charged beyond a reasonable doubt. That is not the test for a prima facie case. For a prima facie case to be established, the court must be satisfied that there is some sort of evidence. So it doesn't have to be strong evidence in these circumstances. We're not talking about the weight or the strength of the evidence, but once there's evidence to substantiate the offense that the person is before the court.
So when the charges are laid,
yes,
a prima facie case is made out. Could be made out.
Yes.
And this is a hearing that comes before a magistrate.
Yes, so it's a... It used to be before the magistrate for serious matters, indictable offences. Now it goes straight to the High Court before a master.
Yeah.
So it goes before a master.
Yes.
And this hearing on this particular court date is just for the state or the prosecution to prove...
A prima facie case. Yes.
Which in essence... I like to talk for the man in the taxi to understand. Which in essence means to prove that they could... Continue with the case.
Yes, that they could substantiate the offense, that there's evidence in relation to the offense.
But isn't that a formation situation? What is formation then?
So usually formation is a term that you would usually hear like a case management, a status update. You put the matter on a date to mention the matter or to call the matter to determine... It's specifically different because we have legislation under, it's called a JIPA, that was passed in December 2023.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Administration of Justice Indictable Proceedings Act that was passed in December 2023 that governs specifically how you treat with sufficiency hearings.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's so formation is, you know, you just go to court and they would determine if there was disclosure given.
Yes, and
you
know, give directions.
But the sufficiency hearing is something different and something very intentional where the state would have to put forward. Now it isn't where they actually call in the persons to give evidence. It's kind of like a paper committal. And from that to determine if there's sufficient evidence to move forward.
That's the prima facie.
Yes. So, but there's a step-by-step process that must be followed. So, under the legislation, when the person is charged, and we are talking specifically for serious matters, as you heard me mention, indictable matters. Mm-hmm. That is the more serious matters, such as rape, attempted murder, murder, and those sorts of things. So when the person is charged for that serious matter, it could be either way. Some matters, for example, robbery, possession of drugs, could be heard either in the High Court or the Magistrates Court. So those matters, once they're laid indictably, you would hear that term a lot of time, the charge is laid indictably and not called upon to plead. So the matter goes before the master in the High Court. And at that first hearing, it's called the initial hearing of the matter, where the charge is read to the person. If it's an either way matter, it's up to the prosecution to indicate whether they are recommending summary trial, meaning transfer the matter back to the district court, the magistrate's court, or they're proceeding as laid, meaning they're proceeding indictably before the High Court. So that is the responsibility of the prosecution now. Before, under the old system, it used to be an election put to the accused person. So in the magistrate's court, the person used to be given the election to say whether or not they prefer to have their matter heard upstairs in the High Court before a judge and or jury, or in the magistrate's court. So when the person comes, as I mentioned, there is that initial hearing where it is the charge is read to the person. The master would also tell the person, deal with the issue of bail, where they can make an application for bail as the case may be. And then they also give directions for certain things to be done. That is the initial hearing process. So they do what is called a scheduling order, basically outlining the prosecution to submit the file to the DPP by a particular day, the prosecution to file all their statements, because remember, the burden is always on the state to prove.
Yeah.
Therefore, when the court gives that direction, the prosecution has that duty to comply with the order of the court, filing all the documents, and now the indictment is filed. Before, under the old system, you used to have the preliminary inquiry, and then when it's completed, the committal bundle or the bundle of evidence is sent to the DPP's office, and then the DPP would file the indictment, which can take some time. Now the indictment has to be filed before the sufficiency hearing is completed, well, before it's even conducted. So when that master gives the scheduling order with the directions, the defense also has the opportunity to file evidential objections, file witness statements in the matter. So it's like you're front loading the case up front, so everybody know what case, what is the case that has to be met. And then you have what is called the sufficiency hearing. At the sufficiency hearing is where the master would look at the evidence that is in the form of the statement. So everything is documentary. If it is the witness doesn't swear or doesn't give a statement, the legislation also allows for the party to call the witness to give oral testimony. That is under Section 19 of the Act. But most times the witnesses give their statement. There are legislative procedures. The statement must be signed. It must be sworn. It must be typewritten, because as attorneys, defense attorneys, we usually have a difficult time understanding these handwritings of these police officers sometimes.
Yes.
But those are the things that has to be done up front. And then at the sufficiency hearing, once the master has gone through the evidence and the state has tendered these statements, meaning put it into evidence, once there is compliance with the proper procedure, and the master is satisfied that there's evidence, they would say, I'm satisfied that there's a prima facie case to answer. And then they would transfer the matter, which is called the committal proceedings. They would transfer the matter for a judge, where the person can elect to have a judge alone trial or a judge on jury.
Yeah. So that's essentially the entire new process. And that's coming, that's the change from the previous preliminary inquiry.
Yes. So before, we had the preliminary inquiry in the magistrate's court, where all matters, whether serious or minor matters, would start in the magistrate's court. So even these indictable matters would have gone to the magistrate, and you would have had a preliminary inquiry, or what you call a PI, in the magistrate's court,
yeah,
where the prosecution would call their witnesses. The accused person would have the opportunity to cross-examine these witnesses, and then that after the conclusion of that process, with the evidence being heard, the magistrate would then determine, the same thing like the master, if there's a case to answer, prima facie case, and send it to the High Court for trial. Yeah. However, the cross-examination process has been eliminated under the new system. So there's no cross-examination of witnesses at the sufficiency hearing stage, unless the witness is coming to give oral testimony, as I mentioned, under Section 19. It's just a formality of the statements, looking at the statements on the face of it to determine if there's evidence and the matter is transferred. So at the trial stage is where the accused person would get the opportunity to cross-examine all the witnesses in the matter.
Yeah. So previously, the preliminary inquiry would have been like a trial before the trial itself.
Sort of, yes.
Yeah. So you feel as though with the new changes with the sufficiency hearings that it's helped move along some of the cases for it to be a bit quicker, to help with the delay in our criminal justice
system. Definitely. It has significantly helped with the delay. For example, we have completed matters that where persons were charged in 2001, 2002, yeah, and the trial has been completed. Yeah. I remember last year, the person was charged, I think, 2002, we were in 2025, so it's in a matter of a three-year period under JIPA. From charge to completion, the matter was completed. Under the old system, sometimes you would take 3-4 years just for the PI, then you wait another few years for the indictment, and then the person comes up for trial. So you used to hear people inside, and they still do have a lot of persons, mm-hmm, especially who would have been caught under the old system in custody for several years. Because I have a client right now, he's been in custody since 2009, which is before a JIPA. So it's the process has significantly streamlined, and it's moving a lot. Masters are moving a lot faster now, but there are still persons in the system who have been charged and there for a long time.
Yeah, because I do know one or two persons who was caught under the old system, and now they are just waiting for the indictment, which sometimes takes a while.
Correct.
And your matter is not moving forward until you actually get that.
That's correct.
Yeah. And then with the scheduling order, because you indicated that there would be a scheduling order with stricter deadlines to follow. And I know under the legislation 5.95C.
Yes, under the criminal procedure rules. So a JIPA is not in isolation. You have the Criminal Procedure Rules 2023, which provides guidelines or rules governing the system. Yeah. So it's not limited to a JIPA. It's generally criminal procedure rules governing matters flowing through the criminal justice system. Yes. But there's a section 5.9, which specifically focuses on a JIPA and whether or not a master could discharge the matter. So,
all right, let's take a quick phone call. Hello, who's there?
Good morning, Davey.
Good morning.
I'm listening to what is being said, and there's something that has dawned on me. I've oft heard it said that there are some persons who are on remand that have been there for time longer than it would take if they were convicted. they would have less years than they're on remand. And one of the things that I'm talking about here, it really doesn't fall under her portfolio, but under the DPP. Why doesn't the DPP just issue what is called a null prosecute? You're not going to prosecute this person anymore, and just free the person, because that just keeps staying there and clogging up the system, and the system is clogged up with this matter to be called. And I find that that is really and truly, you know, overburdening the system for no reason at all, since the person may have already served more time on remand than they would have gotten if they had pleaded guilty or found guilty. Thank you, Alison.
And that is a real issue that persons face. As I mentioned earlier, having a client inside since 2009, he's charged for the offense of murder. And we all know the presumption of innocence. The state has to prove its case. But he's now caught in the system where he has to wait until he could get his trial date.
Yeah.
Likewise, there are several other persons who are inside. But the caller is correct that it's a matter for the Director of Public Prosecution to assess the case, to assess the evidence in the case to determine whether or not this is a matter that can be tried in these circumstances and successfully so. But the thing is, unfortunately, our constitution does not provide for a speedy trial. It provides for a fair trial. Yeah. So there's no right to have a trial within a certain time. Now, I may have my personal views on that, but that is the law. And
I'm thinking, are we going to compromise speed for efficiency and effectiveness? I don't want somebody, because of a speedy trial, found guilty or innocent. Because
yes,
we're hustling to run through this thing and, you know, we miss certain things.
But at the same time, everybody would want to have the matter ventilated before the court sooner rather than later, because mm-hmm. delay always impacts a trial. Sometimes witnesses die. You can't find witnesses. Now, the law makes provision for those things. But then if a key witness dies, the accused person doesn't have the opportunity to cross-examine that person or to test the evidence reliably at trial. Obviously, the court will have to direct the jury or themselves, if it's a judge alone, as it relates to how to treat with that evidence, as well as with time, people tend to forget. So in terms of memory, and even accused persons, they may have defense witnesses, and their defense witnesses may not be available. They may have migrated or as well have died. And unlike the prosecution, where witness statements are usually taken during the investigation stage, the accused person doesn't have that benefit in all the circumstances. Sometimes they may be unrepresented at the beginning and stuff like that. So delay has its negative impact, not only for the accused person who has to wait and have this matter hanging over their head, especially if they're in custody, but as well as the victims, because they would want closure in those matters.
Yeah, and I think we should also separate bringing the matter before the court and then the trial itself. So you're not necessarily saying that the trial itself has to be quick and you know, affect the competence of the trial. Is that if this person is charged, they should be brought before the court within a specific time.
But that happens. That was my next question to you guys. A person is charged, police arrest somebody, and they're charged with murder.
Yes.
All right. How soon after the charges are laid, they are brought to court legally?
Well, once a person is charged, meaning if I'm charged this morning, the law says that the person must be brought immediately or as reasonably practicable before the court. So it shouldn't be I'm charged today, I'm going to court, Monday, Tuesday. It should be that
next
I should be
possible
brought,
time yes. yeah. available.
So if I'm charged this morning, I should be brought sometime before the court today. Because court sits from 9 till 4. Mm-hmm.
All right, so if I'm charged now, before 4, I should be brought before
correct.
Court to answer these charges.
That is correct.
After I come before the court, we're dealing with a non-indictable offender. Hello, good morning.
Hello, morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, my suggestion, why the standard bring back section to the court when it can say 10 years and things, because each and each done gone already. So I don't see why they can bring it back and clear up the system. Thank you.
Well, when you look at a JIPA, in terms of these serious matters, it's geared towards a speedy resolution of the matter. So when you see the timelines, for example, at the initial hearing, the accused person is told or given an alibi warning, meaning they are told that they have to file an alibi notice within 28 days if they are relying on alibi. So that has to be done within 28 days, alternatively before the sufficiency hearing, because if you try to rely on alibi later on, you'll have to get permission from the judge if you don't do it within a timely manner. Likewise, the prosecution is given certain timelines, and those timelines are not a year off. They're usually given from my experience, within a 3-month period where they have to get these statements filed and served before the court. So when you look at the intention of a JIPA and how it's supposed to operate, the sufficiency hearing ought to be completed within a year from the person being charged, ideally. Now, it doesn't always work like that in practice, because the court always have the discretion under the rules, for example, to they may grant an extension because The both sides under the act are allowed to make an application supported by evidence for an extension of time if necessary in these circumstances. So you can't just come and say, well, I am not ready, I need time. You must put evidence before the court. For example, you want vacation leave, you want sick leave, as the case may be, or this witness is hospitalized and you need additional time to get the evidence before the court. So the court does have the discretion to grant an extension of time once they are satisfied that there's evidence to support the application. But all things being equal, it is supposed to happen within a reasonable time, and we're not talking about 3-4 years down the road. So with this new process, it is geared towards a speedy resolution of the matter.
All right, so I like that. But the thing is, when a person is arrested and they are charged, they're taken before the court, and then they are given another date. So you're charged with murder or larceny, motor vehicle larceny. Walk me through the process. You go to court on that first hearing. You get a lawyer.
All right, so let's
that first hearing when you go.
Right, so remember I was mentioning earlier the initial hearing. We charge for murder. You go before the court, and the charge is read to you. If you are unrepresented, the court does an inquiry. They inquire from you whether or not you need an opportunity to get
counsel.
You could have the option whether you want to do it privately or under the act. The court could make an order for the chief public defender to assign a public defender. So last week you would have heard me mention that part of our responsibility in the department is doing sufficiency hearing. So all these matters that come straight to the master, they make the order, and one of us in the department is assigned to deal with the matter or represent the person. Now mind you, for murder charge, the person is assigned initially a duty counsel. So from the time the person is arrested for murder at the police station, the police officers are required to contact the Legal Aid and Advisory Authority because it's a very serious offense, the most serious, that they would contact the Legal Aid and Advisory Authority, and they would assign what is called a duty counsel to the person. That duty counsel is free of charge. That attorney would go to the station, meet with the person, the suspect, advise the person of their rights and so forth, and then they are usually required to appear at the first hearing. Now, on how the legislation works, because when that person appears at the first hearing, if they are unrepresented, the court has to ensure that they have the legal representation. So they are given the opportunity to indicate whether they want it privately. If not, the court makes the order. The order comes to the chief public defender, and then the chief public defender assigns one of us. So representation is dealt with at the initial hearing. Also, the court can deal with the issue of bail. Now, we know under the amendment to the Bail Act in 2024 that persons can apply for bail for murder, but there must be exceptional circumstances. Now there's a current debate going on an amendment, so I wouldn't go further into that. And we also are waiting a court of appeal judgment as it relates to what can amount to exceptional circumstances. But beside that, the issue of bail is usually dealt with at the initial hearing. So the person is before the master. Then the court also inquires from the prosecution is there. The court.
This is on the first hearing.
The first hearing.
First any person appear in court.
Initial hearing. And we're talking about a murder charge.
A murder charge.
Before
right.
the master. Mm-hmm. The court also makes the direction. Police or the state to file their statements by a particular date. Right?
And these statements are
witness statements, so the statements that they would have taken from witnesses, whether police officers who were engaged in the investigation process, whether it's eyewitnesses, relatives of the deceased person. There's usually forensic evidence, post-mortem certificate, post-mortem report as it relates to cause of death and those sorts of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a deadline that is given to the state to file all those things, including the indictment. those things have to be disclosed, meaning it has to be given to the defense so that the accused person and his counsel know what the evidence is in the case to be able to advise the accused person, this is the case that is against you, and take instructions relative to the evidence that relates to the charge.
Yeah.
So the direction is also given for the defense for disclosure, a date when those things have to be handed over to the defense. And the defense is also given an opportunity to respond. So the court would give directions or order the defense to file any evidential objections that they may need to file any witnesses or witness statements that they intend to rely on by a particular date. So this direction or this deadline is usually after they receive. So let's say, for example, the court makes the order for the state, the person goes before the court today and the master hears the matter at the initial hearing and gives the order. Prosecution to file all statements and indictment. Today is what, the 6th?
Mm-hmm.
By the 13th of March. That is relatively a month, 5 weeks from now, right? And thereafter, the defense is given time. So they may give the defense a time in April so that they would have enough time to review the evidence, meet with the client, take instructions to file.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would set the matter for a sufficiency hearing date that is convenient to all the parties.
So that initial hearing goes from there to a sufficiency hearing.
Yes.
Which has a stipulated 6 week period. They could tell you 4 months down the road.
Yes. Well, we have in recent times we've been getting matters, like in 2025 we were getting matters, hearings in 2026, because courts, the amount of matters before the court realistically. Right.
Yeah. And during that time, that person is in custody.
For murder, yes, but they can apply for bail.
Yeah. Because it's a bailable offense.
Yes, they can apply for bail, and once they get the bail, then they can be attending court from outside.
All right. Now, what is the difference between a indictable and indictable?
So
what makes it indictable? What is indictable? What is
okay.
that?
So indictable is what I would have said earlier, a serious offenses. So you have summary offenses, either way offenses, and indictable offenses. An example of a summary offense, obscene language, resisting arrest. Those are minor matters, matters that are dealt with in the magistrate's court,
yeah.
summarily, meaning it's a small matter. It's not all matters are serious, breach of the law at the end of the day, but they are tiered, they are different levels. So you have the small offenses, a cost case, as we yeah. call it, in the magistrate's court, which are dealt with in the various magistrate's court. Then you have either way offenses, which are matters that could be heard either in the magistrate's court, as the name suggests, either in the magistrate's court or in the high court. Some of these offenses, as I said earlier, would be like robbery, possession of drugs, and those sorts of things. So it could go either way. Indictable matters are the really serious matters that must be heard or tried in the high court. So those would include, for example, murder, attempted murder, manslaughter, rape, and those other serious offenses, fraud matters and stuff like that.
Those are indictable.
Indictable. Yeah. Meaning...
So summary offenses is basically indictable. You plead.
No. So summary offenses mean minor offenses. At the end of the day, for a summary offense, if I go before the courts for a cuss case, I am given the opportunity to plead. I could plead guilty or not guilty.
But indictable, you can't.
But
what are the parameters that governs or what are the threshold to say, well, all right, you reach the threshold there? Beyond this isn't.
So it depends. Now, each offense is based in law.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be either through common law, for example, the offense of murder is common law, meaning it's not offense created by statute, but it was created by common law because we were under British rule and stuff like that. It has been there since time immemorial. However, there are certain offenses that are contained in the statute. For example, possession of drugs. There's a Dangerous Drugs Act which governs those offenses. So the legislation or the law would say how the charge is laid. So they could say, so there are some provisions in the legislation that could say the matter could be treated summarily or it could be treated indictably. So it depends on where the how the person is charged. The provision under which or the law under which the person is charged will determine whether the matter could be heard in the magistrate's court, whether the matter could be heard in the high court. As I said before, there's the difference. Before, for either way offences, the matter would have gone to the magistrate and the accused person would usually choose where they want the matter to be heard. Now, for indictable matters and either way matters, it goes straight to the master and the prosecution is the one who would say whether or not they are recommending the matter to be heard in the high court or district court, because they are the ones in possession of the evidence. They would know the case that has to be met. So they are the ones who now would be making the recommendation.
And is a recommendation, it could be denied?
Well, most times, based upon the recommendation, the master would either transfer the matter based upon the recommendation.
But the process is a long-winded one, meaning that the person stays in custody.
No, for the person can apply for bail.
But if they're not, if they're unable,
if they're not granted bail, then the person remains in
and
custody.
And if they're unable to meet
if they are unable to access the bail that is given, they could make an application before the court to vary the bail. Meaning, for example, the person has been inside for 6 months and they cannot access the bail. I have done several bail variations. So, for example, the bail was $250,000 with approval. The man remained.
What is that? What does that mean?
So, for that, for example, if someone is granted bail, the court could say, "I want this to be approved by the registrar." Now, there are different persons in the judiciary that would deal with the processing of bail. So, in the magistrate's court, you have magistracy registrars. In the high court, you have registrars as well, high court registrars. Now, they are the ones who would normally deal with the administrative aspect of things. And before, what you used to have is the JP in the court who would, or the clerk of the peace, who would approve the bail. So a long time you used to hear bail to be approved by the clerk of the peace. Now you hear bail to be approved by the registrar, meaning the person who is going to stand as surety or take the person's bail. If I am going to take, let's say, Andisa's bail, God forbid, she's charged with an offense and she has to get bail, and I am taking the responsibility to take her bail, then I have to put forward certain documents before the court for it to be approved before I can be approved as her surety. So that's what they mean by bail with approval.
What other form of bail they can get? Bail with approval, bail...
So there's bail with surety, named surety,
what
meaning, so instead of me having to go before the court and put forward certain documents such as deeds and those sorts of things, get a valuation report. Yes, it's a process.
So you ain't getting bail that same day.
Very unlikely, unless you submit the documents beforehand for prior approval by the registrar, it's very unlikely. So there's bail with surety as well. For example, I could appear before the court when she's charged and the court could make certain inquiries of me, or I could do a statutory declaration outlining my assets. I have, I'm employed, I have a house, I have a vehicle, etc. And I don't have any criminal charges. I'm not known to the police, those sorts of things. And the court could be satisfied that I'm an appropriate surety and they would take my identification card number, either your ID card number or your DP number, and they would put you as named surety. So that circumvents the process where you need to get approval by the registrar. There's also cash bail as an alternative as well, where a sum is deposited into the court and it is held there as security until the matter is completed.
So, if cash bail, if they ask for 50,000, you're paying 50,000?
Yes, via check to the registrar.
And they hold that 50?
Until the matter is
but
completed.
But that'll be a manager's check?
Yes, that's correct.
Right, so you get a manager's check from the bank?
Yes.
And that could happen same day too?
Yes.
Or but so that to prevent you from going into prison overnight?
Yes, yeah. That is a possibility.
And those are the three options for bail.
Yes, sometimes for minor offences, you could get what is called own bail.
Yeah.
You very rarely get that for indictable and serious offences.
So own bail comes how?
Own bail is basically the courts assessing the summary of evidence in the matter, because the Bail Act, as well as the criminal procedure rules, outline certain factors, primarily the Bail Act. Certain factors you have to take into account, the person antecedents, meaning their criminal record, their social ties to the community, and those sorts of things. And they could say, well, in these circumstances, I do not consider you a flight risk, and there are no allegations that you would commit an offense while in bail, or there are no allegations that you would interfere with state witnesses in these circumstances, so I'll give you your own bail, meaning the person signed for themselves. Now, a sum is attached to that, so they might say own bail in the sum of $10,000. It doesn't mean that you have to pay the $10,000, but if you skip court or you fail to attend court, they will call upon you to say for you to answer why we should not hold you accountable to pay that $10,000. But basically, own bail is you signing responsibility
and
for yourself to attend court.
Now, if in some instances, and this is from Texas, where you get bail and you stand bail for Andisa.
Yes.
I pick up Andisa and say, Gil, we bust the tape. Your house, your car, your land. And she and I go and we bust out, we in Dubai.
Right.
Can't find me. Miss Court. We wanted, she wanted now. What happens to you?
So, as the surety, and that is a huge responsibility for anyone taking bail. I would now be responsible to answer to the court, and they would issue what is called a summons to show cause, which is basically summonsing me as a surety before the court to answer why it is I should not be held accountable, why I shouldn't lose my property that I put up for Andisa, why it is I shouldn't be held accountable to pay this $200,000+ that I may have bound myself to, because it's basically an undertaking to take responsibility for this person to show up in court.
Right, but what defense you could have now? You trying to call Andisa and...
Right, so that's why at the hearing, the person has to explain themselves.
So,
it's a summons, it's a to show cause, meaning you have to show cause why it is you should not be held accountable for all these things. But it's at the discretion of the judicial officer conducting the hearing whether you are held accountable in these circumstances.
Give an example as to how they're going to hold you accountable, because what you're just telling me here, this is subjected to me, how I feel on that day. I watch you, mean like how you look. I listen to you telling me, well, I know I didn't know where she went. I was trying to call her and she never answered.
So everybody
will come with that story. So
that's why it's important. So I have seen persons put before the court, or even they come before the court even issues a summons, and say, well, I cannot get on to this person and I want to be removed as the surety. So some of them do take in front if they realize that the person that they stood for shaking them, running off, and they cannot find
the
person.
That doesn't make sense. Because if you're telling me I have to stand bail for you and I am taking a responsibility to bail you out, and then you skip town, and then I could come back and say, well, listen, I can't find them, you know. So take me off, and they'll say, all right, you can't find them, and I take you off.
So it's not automatic, as I said before. It's a hearing, and it has to be based upon the evidence that is put forward. So the person may bring telephone records and say, well, I tried reaching out to this person 15 times and I have been unable. I went to the person's address where I know the person lives, and I have not been able to find this person. So you would have to show substantial reason why it is you should not be held accountable. Well, because you, when you take that bail, that is a risk you are taking.
Right. So you bring that evidence, and I am quite certain I would bring it, and everybody would bring that. I've got WhatsApp is a good thing, you know. I've been WhatsApping. I send WhatsApp calls. I ring in your phone. I could print it out by Digicel OTSTT, and I bring it to court, and then I could video record myself walking by your house and calling you 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock in the day, can't find you. All that could be done. I could have a neighbor tell me, well, they ain't see you neither for a while, and then the court says, what next? I still subjected to a judicial officer, which I find is wrong.
Well, that
because
is,
it
that
simply
is a
means
responsibility. You take on.
Right, but I take what I'm getting at is that I can get out of it once I could provide reasonable cause as to why I should no longer be held responsible, because I can't find it. I think the issue of bail, and I'm not saying this lightly, is that if that person skip, you ought to be paid. Now, if you could really show something outside of the box, why you shouldn't be held accountable, I could go with that. But what you just said there is normal thing. People go disappear and they're trying.
And it all
that
depends.
Normal.
It all depends on the
that's nothing reasonable. That is expected. I expect you to try to call the person because it's your property up for grabs now. You're going to be homeless. So I expect you're going to reach out.
But the court will obviously consider all the evidence. So it isn't just that on this day I tried calling this person 5 times. The court would want to know how much times, how much days, how much effort you actually made.
Here,
and it isn't automatic from that they would say, okay, fine, you're off the hook.
Well, that's my point. Yeah. But that's still subjected. My point I'm getting, you still vetoing everything. You still making a decision. You ain't God. But here they think there's no legislation providing a threshold for it.
The judicial officer.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
But in everything, with any offense, any matter that's before the court, it's about the evidence and the court exercising its discretion based upon the evidence.
I got that. But every dog and the cat go come and say, I can't find you now. I know you ought to come to court on the 14th of February. That is next week, Saturday. I'm just saying, right? You are supposed to go to court on the 14th. All right, let me use a realistic day, the 13th. You're supposed to show up on the 13th. All right, I might call it today. I hear you and whatever. Me bothering you all the time.
Yeah.
So how I can show the court, I keep calling it. So when I see the 13th, and I wake up in the morning, I say, hey, we are court this morning, I can't get you. I reach the court to make sure that you're there, log in, whatever it is. You're not there. At that time, I panic in. But I wouldn't panic before that. Why is that evidential? I trying to reach you before, because what if you never answer my call before, but then you disappear on the day. Yeah. So
I feel like what we also need to explain is that the first time that the person doesn't appear before the court wouldn't automatically issue a summons for the person to show cause. The first time the person doesn't appear, the court might issue a summons for that defendant.
Correct.
And after, if it's becoming a habit on several occasions, several court dates you have missed, then they would issue a warrant for arrest for that person, for the defendant. And I mean, it's only if they can't really and truly find the person. That's kind of like the last resort when they will issue a summons for the person to show cause. So it isn't that you took a name surety for someone, the person doesn't appear one day, and then you had to go before the court to explain why the person didn't appear one day.
An arrest warrant could also be issued. I had to put a pin there, and I'll allow you all to clarify for 10 minutes after, and then I know you all have to go.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability, the all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.
All right, guys, good morning. This is the extended version to justice. They were on time today, but Robin, I kidnapping them a little bit. I ain't kidnapping nobody. I asked them kindly to stay back with me for a few minutes just to clear up some issues here as we educate persons on the law and what it means to you. Justice in Trinidad and Tobago. So very quickly, as we're talking about the bail amendments, Andisa brought up the issue as to explain thoroughly how it works. Now, what we got from you is that as you skip, so how long, okay, you missed the first hearing, you didn't show up. Now, you bail Andisa somewhere in Dubai, so she didn't show up once, twice. How long before they can actually call you? But before you take that, hello, good morning, quickly.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Levy.
Morning.
This is, I am 65 years old. I just come in late on your program, but I wanted to get a number to get on to these people because I have a serious matter before the High Court. And
all right, well, they will give you their numbers now. You can go if you whichever one.
Yeah, you could contact.
If you want to pay, you have to call Andisa. If you're looking for public defense, you have to call.
No, which area is he from?
Which area?
I am from the Mafeking area.
Mafeking.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's Miaro.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think the closest office to him would be either South, unless he wants to go to the Arima office.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Which office is close to you, South or Arima?
To get to South will be easier for me.
Okay, San Fernando.
Right. So the Legal Aid San Fernando office.
Take this number.
Is at Harris Street. One moment. It's at Harris Street, San Fernando. So he could go in at any point in time.
Harris Street, San Fernando, the Legal Aid building.
It's so he could go in at any point in time and speak with an attorney there.
Mm-hmm.
The consultation is $50.
Mm-hmm.
And let me get a contact number for the San Fernando office.
All right. So you're calling this number, right? Yeah. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he could
638-5222.
That's the standard legal aid number.
638-5222.
Yes.
5222.
Right. And it's $50 charge for your consultation. And okay. That's not too much. That's not too much. That's, a, that's
no,
fairly.
That's not too much.
Right? And you will be able to get some help, but you go to the San Fernando branch at Harris Street in San Fernando.
Harris Street, San Fernando.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you so much for calling. Right.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Adili.
All right, take care. So as we wrap the interview this, or the conversation on justice this morning, we're dealing with the bail and sufficiency hearings.
Yes.
So
as Andisa was explaining, the person doesn't appear on the first occasion. The court has the discretion, whether or not on that first occasion, to issue a warrant mm-hmm. for that person's arrest, or depending, may issue a summons for the person to appear before the court. If the person is represented, the attorney may, in the circumstances, ask for leave for the person to appear through them if there's some explanation, perhaps the person may be in hospital or whatever. But in this case, the person has skipped. So the attorney may say, well, I have no contact with my client and I'm in the court's hands. So the court may adjourn the matter to give the person an opportunity to appear again. And if that person still does not appear, then a warrant for that person's arrest is issued by the court.
Mm-hmm.
The court, in determining whether to issue a warrant for the person's arrest, looks at the history of the person's attendance, whether or not the person has ever missed court before, they habitually attend, and the attendance time, and those sorts of things. So those are considerations that the judicial officer will give before issuing a warrant. Once the warrant is issued for the person's arrest, the court can also issue a summons for the person, for the bailer, who stands as surety, to appear before the court to show cause. So there's no set time frame. It all depends.
Yeah.
The discretion of the judicial officer, whether they issue a warrant immediately or give opportunity for the person to appear, failing which, there, once the person does not appear after sufficient attempts has been made, then the...
They can summon the bailer
to come in. Because really and truly, the bailer is supposed to be attending court.
Yeah.
And attending court with the accused person to make sure the person attend court
right.
on each and every occasion.
So yeah. if the bailer has been attending and the person has been showing up
correct.
All the time, and then all of a sudden the person stops showing up, but the bailer is there.
Yes.
It shows that they have been seeking interest in this
correct.
Person, and now the person skipped. So they don't automatically take your property.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
Have there ever been
a
situation in this country, because I know you all deal with refer to different cases now. Of the past?
I personally have not dealt with that,
yeah.
but there was one occasion when I was in private practice sitting in magistrate's court where the magistrate was conducting a hearing
yeah.
To show cause
yeah.
and the bailer came and explained and stuff like that. And in that instance, I don't think that they were penalized in any way. There was... Their property was not interfered with, as best as I could recall,
mm-hmm.
based upon the explanation and the evidence they give of the attempts and stuff like that. Their property was not seized
yeah.
in any circumstances, because they did all that they could.
Yeah, and I also dealt with a situation where the court was like, this is what is happening. The person isn't appearing and giving you one occasion to get your house in order, get an attorney if you can, and on the next occasion you'll have to show cause. So, yeah.
All right, great. Guys, in closing, anything you want to share with the public before you guys go? Because I know you have to go. I'm letting you go, all right? Anything in closing, Andisa? This is your show.
Yeah, in closing, I think that it's so amazing that we could have persons like Adafia coming in and explaining these different areas of law, because I think that some persons don't have access to justice, access to this legal advice, to know that what are the options available. Last week when we were on our way out, we were kind of talking about how persons didn't necessarily know of the existence of the Public Defender's Department, and also of the competence of the Public Defender's Department to be able to give persons legal advice. So I hope that persons actually learn something when they tune into justice. And thank you so much, Adafia, for coming in for the second time.
Yep.
Very willing.
So,
thank you.
Adafia,
I wasn't sure if you were joking last week, baby, when you said... I'll see you back next week.
Yeah. And we ain't joking when we say we'll see you next week, Friday. God spare life. You can come back at us. We did much efficiency hearing. There's more. Let's find out what the defense attorneys in this country, what kind of cases you all handle, and explain deeper, you know. And Andisa is taking a rest, but she's here. All right. So, guys.
One thing. So, in addition to public defenders and sensitizing the public, we also do articles, the Legal Aid and Advisory Authority. We do articles.
See?
Simplifying the law. So y'all could check out today's Guardian. There's an article.
What page?
Just
all right, it's in the Guardian. That's most important.
It's
all right,
in the Guardian
it.
Today. About strict liability.
Strict liability.
Yes.
I see the comic strip. That is probably Eric. All right. It's in the Guardian somewhere here. We will find it. I'll look for it before the show done. So thank you very much.
It's on page 25.
Do we have any Guardian? Yeah, all them pages here, boy. I don't read so far when I read it that way. All right. So it's on page 25. That's right. Ignorance is no excuse. Hey. I say even this. We talk about this next week. We're talking this next week.
You're trying to get me into Porter's Speed and Carnival, right?
Nah, yeah. Okay, yeah, break up in the carnival costume. Let me see what's going
at
on. So, guys, thank you so much. That concludes another edition of Justice. Ignorance is no excuse. Law on strict liability explained. The autonomy of the office, the strict liability in daily life, and calls for greater awareness. My goodness. I'm so sorry I didn't see this earlier. So, next week now.
I'll think about it. I'll definitely give
you
it some
time. You sure you want me to let you leave this building? Because we can keep you and bring some clothes. You take a shower and you stay here until next week to cover this, you know?
Force and
the best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.